Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. There's true history in this hour. Later on, from Adventures and Research from 1946, but first a broadcast of Mr. President from July 17, 1947 on ABC.
Mr. President, starring Edward Arnold. The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present Mr. President with Edward Arnold. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our country, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little known stories of the men who lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. The true human stories of Mr. President. Let's visit Mr. President in the White House. It is evening, and only one window shows a light, a study on the ground floor. We find ourselves in the corridor outside his office.
I'll go right in. Some visit for you, Mr. President.
Hello. Sit down, won't you? You know, some people think when they cross the threshold of the White House, they step into a maze of state secrets and official documents. Well, in a way, that's right. But we have our lighter moments and the exciting ones, too. Sometimes they become almost too exciting. For instance, this story I'm going to tell you tonight. Which president was I when this story happened? I'll tell you later on. But meanwhile, see if you can guess. Well, my story begins with one of the lighter moments. Come in.
Evening, Mr. President. Ready for some refreshments?
Good for you, Ralph.
Yes, sir, the usual. Ginger ale and orange juice.
Did you make it with California oranges?
No, sir. I made it with Florida oranges. They're better.
Now, Ralph, haven't you been following my campaign? Am I going to win the election if you keep favoring Florida with oranges, eh?
Well, yes, sir, I know that. I know all about that. Yes,
well, go on.
I'll tell you what I'll do, sir. I'll use California oranges after the election. Then I'm going back to Florida. After all, Mr. President, you wouldn't want a man to desert his native state. Here's your drink, sir.
Thank you. It's delicious.
Excuse me, Mr. President. Your campaign manager's here.
Oh, have him come in, Miss Sarah.
All right, Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Miss Sarah. Mr. President, I'm glad you're able to see me tonight.
Sit down, Clark. Ralph, will you pour Mr. Clark a nightcap?
Thank you, sir.
I'll leave the pitcher handy on this table, Mr. President.
All right, Ralph. Now, Clark, what can I do for you?
Mr. President, frankly, I'm worried about the campaign.
What did you learn on your recent trip?
New Jersey, Rhode Island, all along the eastern seaboard. It's the same story.
That I'm losing the election.
That's right. I've been talking, working 18 hours a day, but it's no use. The people want war, and Wells is playing up to that. Just yesterday, he came out accusing you of being an appeaser. He even went so far as to say you're a weakling, that you lack courage to stand up for the country's rights. Now, how can I answer him?
Well, that must be difficult for you.
Difficult? It's an impossible situation. Don't you understand? I can't sit by and watch you being cut down without doing something about it.
Mr. Clark, I'm afraid you don't understand the position I'm in.
What do you mean?
Knowing how I feel, I don't believe that I can continue in the campaign.
But, Mr. President...
Already since this election began, our sovereign rights have been ruthlessly violated. I can't use the normal diplomatic channels to avoid getting into conflict. I've tried that. The first time American lives are lost, our people will demand a showdown. That will mean a declaration of war.
In other words...
I have used every means at my command to avoid war. And now I believe it is hopeless. Don't you see where that puts all my campaign arguments?
I understand
Any
that,
change but... in my platform would be an open admission that I have failed.
Well, isn't that true, sir?
For diplomatic reasons, I can't admit that publicly.
Then we have no recourse against Wells.
That is correct.
But what about our party?
There is nothing I can do about that. There are some things more important than the party.
Well... what do you plan to do?
Resign.
What?
I thought it would startle you. It did me when I first thought about it.
How can you do it, sir?
I have a plan. It is not finally worked out, but I should be able to tell you about it in a few days.
What of the election and our party?
We lose the election as gracefully as we can. As to the party, I'm afraid the country comes first.
I can see you've made up your mind.
Yes.
I've thought a great deal upon what would be my duty if Wells is elected. During the 4 months before his inauguration, I would still be president without such moral backing from the nation as would be necessary to steady and control our relations with other governments.
Yes, your position would be difficult.
Difficult? I would be known to be the rejected, not the accredited spokesman of the country. And yet the accredited spokesman would be without legal authority to speak for the nation.
If only there was some constitutional provision.
All my life I have advocated such responsible government for the United States. Responsible government means government by those whom the people trust, and trust at the time of decision and action.
You realize what precedent this sort of thing could set?
I do. Such action on my part would inaugurate, at least by example, a remedy for the disadvantage of having to live for 4 months after an election under a party whose guidance has been rejected at the polls.
You honestly believe there's no other way?
In ordinary times, it would perhaps not be necessary. But in the existing circumstance, it's imperative. The choice of policy in respect of our foreign relations rests with the executive. No such situation has ever existed before. And I have no right to risk the peace of the nation by remaining in office after I've lost my authority.
And you intend going ahead with the necessary preparations?
That's correct, Mr. Clark.
Will you keep me posted?
You can depend upon that.
President, I hope you're feeling well today.
Thank you, Miss Sarah.
I brought in our current election file. I thought you'd want to go over it this morning.
No, not now, Miss Sarah.
Very well.
Would you get Secretary of State Atkins on the phone, please?
Yes. By the way, Mr. President, would you mind if Joseph came in to do the windows?
Windows? They look all right to me. Oh, don't worry about them, Miss Sarah. You can have Joseph clean them later. Now, get Atkins on the wire for me, please.
Yes, Mr. President. State Department, Secretary Atkins, please. The president is calling.
If I could just make him see my...
What, Mr. President?
Oh, nothing.
Excuse me. The secretary is on the phone now.
Hello? Good morning, Atkins.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Did you receive any answer to our last note on their seizing American property?
No answer yet, Mr. President.
Any reports from our overseas departments?
No, sir. We've had a quiet morning so far.
So far, eh? No news is good news, is that it?
That's right. Clark was over to see me this morning.
Yes?
He's quite disturbed. He feels the election is hopeless.
Yes, I know. Did he tell you anything of my plan?
No, Mr. President. But he did indicate that you were, well, shall we say, disinterested in the campaign. I must say that I'm surprised.
I imagine many people in my administration are going to be surprised. But as Secretary of State, surely you understand my reasons.
Yes, I think I do. But can't you alter your campaign policies to fit this situation overseas?
I'm afraid it's too late.
Mr. President, I'd like to discuss this further with you in person.
Fine. I'd like to talk with you, too.
May I come over this afternoon?
I wish you would.
Thank you, sir.
Goodbye, Atkins.
Mr. President.
Mr. Atkins will be over soon. Let's keep the afternoon clear for a long meeting.
Mr. President.
Did you understand about Atkins?
I understand perfectly about Atkins.
Well, what is it, then?
I'm worried about Joseph.
Joseph?
Yes, he's waiting in the hall with his mops and buckets.
Oh, for heaven's sake, let him come in and get the windows done with. I think I've been outmaneuvered here.
All right, Joseph, you can come in now.
Excuse me, Mr. President, but Miss Sarah said you wanted these windows cleaned.
Well, Joseph, that's not an accurate statement of the situation, but come on in just the same.
Yes, sir. Mr. President.
Yes, Joseph.
Do you mind if I ask you a question? I don't want to disturb you, but...
No, go right ahead, Joseph.
Well, sir, do you believe we're going to get in this war?
Why, a good many people seem to think so.
Yes, Mr. President, I know. And if you'll excuse me, sir, well, the way things are going, I have to agree with them.
Well, Joseph, every man's entitled to his opinion.
I've done a good bit of thinking about it, Mr. President. You see, I don't imagine you know this, but I got relatives over there.
Oh, you have?
Yes, sir. Matter of fact, Mr. President, some of my people have already lost their lives in this war.
I'm sorry, Joseph. I didn't know it.
It's been working on my mind, sir. So much so that, well, I decided to do something about it.
And what are you going to do, Joseph?
I'm resigning, sir.
Resigning?
Yes, sir. I've made up my mind to enlist.
I see. It seems like everybody's resigning.
I don't understand you, sir.
Joseph, you realize the possible consequences.
Yes, sir. I'll be over there at a time when it might cost me my life.
Well, as long as you're sure.
It's hard for you to understand how I feel, isn't it, Mr. President?
No, Joseph, I understand better than you imagine. You see, in one way or another, all of us are being called upon to make sacrifices.
That's how I look at it, Mr. President.
Of course, Joseph, we may not all serve in just the same way.
No, but I won't feel satisfied till I'm in uniform.
I understand, Joseph. If I had a reason such as yours, I'd want to get in there and fight, too.
Haven't you got a reason, Mr. President?
Not yet, Joseph, and I hope I won't have.
I hope so, too. Well, the windows are clean, sir.
All right, Joseph, all right.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Yes?
Miss Sarah, let me know the minute Mr. Atkins arrives.
I will, Mr. President.
It looks very much as though Wells is going to win the election. That means our people want him as their president beginning this November. Why should they have to wait until March for him to be inaugurated?
Well, as you know, the Constitution is written that way.
True, but there is another interesting provision in our laws.
What's that?
That the Secretary of State be second in line to succeed the chief executive.
I don't understand what you're driving at, Mr. President.
Simply this. Suppose on the day that Wells wins the election, I resign.
Resign?
That's correct. And let's suppose that my vice president and my secretary of state also resign.
Mr. President, you...
My final act before leaving the office would be to appoint Wells secretary of state in your place.
Then you mean...
Yes, I mean that Wells would automatically take office as chief executive 4 months before his inauguration would ordinarily be due.
I've got to compliment you. It is an ingenious plan.
Ingenious, yes. But does it appeal to you, Mr. Secretary?
I don't know what to say, Mr. President.
It would spare us all 4 difficult months. More important than that, much more important, America would present a united front.
Yes, but...
Tell me this, Mr. Atkins. If I can get the vice president to agree, would you give your consent?
That is something I shall have to think over, Mr. President.
If the vice president and I both resign, you'd be alone here in a most embarrassing situation with a Congress largely against you.
True enough.
Well, then,
if the vice president goes along with you, I shall have to give my consent.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Atkins. And Miss Sarah, see if you can arrange for the vice president to come over this afternoon.
But, Mr. President, there's no precedent for what you're attempting to do.
And there's no precedent for the current situation.
I just don't like the thought of this resignation.
Neither do I, Mr. Lewis. But in my position, I do many things I don't like.
Are you sure there is no other way?
I'm very sure.
Well, all right. You have my consent.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Well, I won't keep you any longer. I know you have a great many matters to attend to.
Yes, that's quite true. Good day, Mr. President. I'll tell Adkins what we have decided.
Good day, and thank you.
Mr. President, now that your callers have gone... Don't you want to look over the reports on your campaign?
No. Let's put that off a while, Miss Sarah.
Well, I don't want to be a nuisance, Mr. President, but the election's only 2 months off, and I know you generally keep very close touch with your people in the field.
Yes, I know.
I don't like to seem curious, Mr. President.
You're always curious, Miss Sarah.
In a way, I feel it's the Secretary's duty.
Miss Sarah, any time I find you neglecting your duties, I'll remind you of it. But so far, that has never been necessary.
Anything more I can do for you, Mr. President, before I go?
Yes, phone Clark and ask him to come and see me the first thing in the morning. I've got some news for him. You might say he's the last stronghold to be taken in this pact.
What did you say?
Nothing, Miss Sarah. Good night.
Good morning, Mr. President. My, you're in a good mood.
Who am I? I believe you can thank the cook for that.
I notice you whistle that tune when things are going well.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps so. Is Clark here?
Yes, just a moment. I'll ask him to come in. Come in, Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Clark. Have you talked with Atkins?
Yes, I have.
Then you know they have agreed to resign.
I do, sir. And I'm sorry to hear of it.
Well, I'm not going to try and justify this thing to you again, Clark. But I should like you to do everything you can to make my reasons for this clear to our party members.
I'll do my best.
They've worked hard in this election, and I wouldn't want them to think that I had purposely let them down.
I'm sure that it can be handled.
And please express my gratitude to all the district leaders. I shall write each one of them a personal note.
That would help, sir.
And Clark, I'm very grateful to you for all that you've done.
Thank you, sir.
Goodbye, Clark.
Good day, sir.
Miss Sarah?
Yes, Mr. President.
Miss Sarah, I want you to take a letter to the Vice President and send a copy to Secretary Atkins, and Clark should get one, too.
Mr. President.
Miss Sarah, are you not writing?
Mr. President, when are you going to tell me what this secret is that seems to be going the rounds? Everybody knows about it but your secretary.
Miss Sarah, I'm surprised at you. There's no secret.
But what is this plan of attack you speak of?
I want the Vice President and the Secretary of State to resign.
Resign?
That's right, so I can join them.
But I don't understand.
Miss Sherry, how do you feel about the situation overseas? Do you think we can stay out of this war?
From all I can read, there's not much chance we can stay out of it, Mr. President.
That's exactly what I think. And I don't want to be the one to send thousands of young Americans to their death on foreign soil.
I understand.
Whoever is president during the next term may not have a choice, but I'm grateful that I still have one.
You were going to dictate a letter to the Vice President and Secretary of State.
Yes. Gentlemen, I am sending the attached statement for your comments and suggestions. As you understand, my statement will be announced to the press simultaneously with the announcements of the Vice President and the Secretary of State. Did you get that?
Yes, I did. And the statement?
Oh, yes, the statement. I hereby offer my resignation as President of the United States, commencing immediately. The newly appointed Secretary of State under the laws provided for in the Constitution will take office as President.
Hello?
Secretary Atkins, Miss Sarah. May I speak to the President?
Just a moment. It's Secretary Atkins.
Good. Yes, Atkins.
An answer to a note has just come in.
What's the nature of it?
It's written in pretty plain language, Mr. President. They're replying to our charges of seizing American property. Their attitude seems to be they'll take what they want, whenever they want it.
I see.
Another thing, Mr. President. Dennis cables that he expects renewed incidents directed against American interests in the Mediterranean and the Far East.
I understand. Very well, Atkins. Well, events are moving faster than I expected.
What does that mean?
That we have very little time. Well, let me see. Where was I, Miss Sarah?
You just finished dictating the note to the Vice President.
Oh, yes. See that it's delivered immediately and ask the press room to keep me informed. Any new developments, Miss Sarah?
Yes, Mr. President. A note just delivered to the State Department. They threaten unrestricted warfare against our shipping in the English Channel.
Mr. President, the Federal Bureau just informed me of a plot to blow up the key bridges in the metropolitan areas of the United States.
Mr. President, the opposing candidate last night in his address at Philadelphia disclosed a plan to attack the United States from Mexico. He accused you of knowing of the plot and keeping it a secret from the public.
I wonder how much longer we'll have to stay out of this thing.
Shall I close the window?
No, let them shout. They have a right to voice their feelings.
It's Mr. Wells' talk last night that's doing it.
It's just adding to it. It's the threat of attacks on our shipping and what they're doing to England and France.
Mr. President, is there anything else you can do?
No, I've sent notes. I've demanded that our rights as a neutral nation be respected. And what have we gotten in return? Abuse. There's no alternative. There's no alternative now but to declare war. And the worst part of it is, I think our enemies know that and are waiting for it.
Then why not go ahead?
That is not my position. It is the people's, and it must be their decision. And until I'm sure that they are unanimous, I must continue to wait.
Hello?
Atkins, is the president in?
Oh, just a moment. It's Mr. Atkins.
I'll take it. Yes, Atkins.
Mr. President, it's happened. A surprise attack this morning. 114 American lives lost. The news should break on the streets any moment.
They meant what they said in their last note.
Yes, and I'm afraid this is only the beginning.
Well, I'm going back into the fight, Atkins.
You mean a declaration of war?
Only a personal declaration of war now. This is going to be a long fight, Atkins, and I'm starting at the beginning.
And that means the resignation.
The resignation is out. They've started something that I hope to finish.
Mr. President,
Have you heard the news?
Joseph, you shouldn't break in like
that.
That's
all right, Miss Surrey. Yes, I have, Joseph.
What does it mean?
That you and I have got some work to do. First, I have an election to win, and after that, we'll see if our enemies haven't taken on more than they can bargain for.
Mr. President, may I come in?
Yes, indeed, Clark. Come in.
I got your message, and I've made all the arrangements, sir. Your first speech will be in Cleveland. I've scheduled them in strategic cities west, ending in California.
All right, Clark. Anything you say.
Thank you, sir. Oh, I'm glad we're getting into this fight before it's too late.
I hope you're right on that, Clark. Their character, their cargo, their destination, their errand have been sent to the bottom without warning. That, I say, is more than human tolerance can stand. I have advocated peace with all my being. Now I advocate preparedness, alertness with all my being.
Speaking as a candidate for the presidency, I wish to bring to your attention the turnabout which the honorable gentleman now holding that office has made. I say to you, don't be fooled. A man who cries peace, peace in one breath and war in the next is not a fit leader of our armed forces.
Had word back in the press room. The latest news they report shows the president is gaining.
Don't get excited.
But, Miss Sarah, don't you know what that means?
It means he still has a fighting chance.
Let no man, let no group of men believe they can flaunt the flag of the United States with impunity.
And still he talks. My opponent evidently thinks he can fight battles with words. Let me remind him, his fine words did not protect those 114 American lives. I hold the president personally responsible for the disaster.
People of California, I have tried during this campaign to present the true facts behind this present world crisis. What is your will in the matter? I respectfully await your decision.
It doesn't look good, Clark.
There goes Minnesota to Wells.
That's 12 more electoral votes.
And Pennsylvania. That's 38.
Gentlemen, I think the sensible thing is to concede this election.
Mr. President, perhaps you're forgetting. There are some of the western states that haven't yet been heard from.
I'm afraid most of the West will be in the Wells column.
Gentlemen, I'm rather tired. I think all of us are. I know you've been working very hard. There really isn't any purpose to our following the returns any longer.
Mr. President, you've made a magnificent try.
Thank you, Atkins. You know I appreciate all you've done.
What do you plan now, Mr. President?
Our path is clear. I intend to follow my original plan of resigning. Good night, gentlemen. Good night, Miss Sarah. Come in.
Mr. President, I brought the trunk you asked for.
Oh, thank you, Joseph.
Mr. President, I'm sorry about the election.
Oh, that's all right, Joseph. It was to be expected.
Shall I start to pack the stuff?
Stuff? Stuff, Joseph? Why, that's my favorite golfing sweater. It's my favorite trout fishing hat. And I wouldn't trade that croquet mallet for anything in the world. They have all done good service. And I intend to put them to work again as quickly as possible.
Mr. President, I've been wondering, sir, how does the president go about resigning?
Where did you hear that, Joseph?
All the servants are talking about it.
Well, I knew it would get out, but I hope not this quickly.
Is it so difficult to resign? It was easy for me. All I did was turn in my notice, and I got 2 weeks extra pay.
Well, it won't be quite that simple for me, and I'll not get 2 weeks extra pay. And if the newspapers get hold of it before it's final, all I get will be headaches.
Mr. President, can I President, we've got some late election returns.
So what is it, Miss Sarah?
The returns have just come in from California. It looks like you're leaving out there.
Are you sure? Why,
this is true, sir. When I came to the White House this morning, I went straight to the press room. The new returns were just coming in. With California in our corner, it gives you a margin of 23 electoral votes.
Clark!
You've won, sir.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Thank you, Joseph. It looks like we're both going to be in there fighting.
Yes, sir.
Joseph, I guess you better put those things back into the storeroom.
Your Western trip did the trick, sir. Swung California.
The crowd has heard the news, Mr. President. They're expecting a word from you. They've been gathering on the lawn since early this morning.
I think it would be good if you would speak to them, Mr. President.
All right. Why don't you all come down with me? There's one choice we cannot make. We're incapable of making. We will not choose the path of submission and suffer the most sacred rights of our nation and our people to be ignored or violated. And so I now accept the responsibility that you, the American people, have placed in me for the struggle that is to come. Sorry, you don't seem to be very happy.
Oh, I was just thinking how near we came to having a vacation.
Yes, I've thought of the same thing many times these past few days.
Sir, could I come in?
Yes, certainly, Ralph.
I thought you might like a little refreshment along about now. Ginger ale and orange juice.
Ralph, is it made with...
California oranges, Mr. President.
Fine.
Yes, sir, I've changed my allegiance. I'll just put the pitcher here on the table.
Thank you, Ralph. And Ralph, you can take the day off tomorrow and get some rest. These last few days have been pretty hard.
Thank you, sir.
Does that apply to me?
It does not. Mm. You've got too much work to do.
I knew that all the time, Mr. President. I'd have been here whether you wanted me or not.
You know, sometimes I think you put up a tougher argument than Wells. He'd at least concede a point once in a while.
Why wouldn't he? After all, he's a man.
Miss Sari, I learned a long time ago, never argue with a woman. You're bound to lose.
Exactly, Mr. President.
Exactly, Miss Sarah. Well, we did get into the war and finally won it. And very few people ever knew how close their president had come to resigning. Nothing like that has ever happened, and maybe never will. But it was awfully close that time. Well, have you guessed who I was when all this happened? It really did happen, you know. Yes, it's a true story. And it happened in 1916, when Woodrow Wilson was Mr. President and enjoyed a good glass of orange juice and ginger ale and a rollicking game of croquet in the White House lawn. Won't you join us again next week? I've got another story I'm sure you'll enjoy. Good night.
Edward Arnold may currently be seen with Clark Gable, Deborah Carr, Sidney Greenstreet, and Adolph Marju in Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's production of The Hucksters. Mr. President is produced by Robert G. Jennings, directed by Dwight Houser. Miss Sarah is played by Betty Lou Gerson. Tonight's script by Richard Dana was based on an episode in the administration of Woodrow Wilson. Music was composed and conducted by Basil Adlam. Next week, when Edward Arnold brings you another story of Mr. President. Owen James speaking. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Mr. President, on Tuned to Yesterday, a broadcast from ABC, heard on July 17th, 1947. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVelnier. Now time for a broadcast of Adventures in Research called The Paper Invention That Worked, a syndicated episode from August 6th, 1946.
Adventures in Research.
Feed those furnaces! Feed them! Take coal to make steam, you lug! Shovel it in!
Yeah, coal. Throw in the coal. Feed your life away in those furnaces so the captain can sail full speed ahead.
That's steam. What's the matter with you? Don't come, you hear?
Oh, you lugs want to know if you're local. This is Paul Shannon introducing another in a series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here is Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, who brings you our story today.
Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone. This is a story of a scientist who wrestled with a principle, put it to work, and disappeared. You've heard his name many times in these recent years. Well, you should, for he harnessed a powerful force of nature. His name?
Rudolf Diesel. I was born in Paris in the middle of the century just past. My parents had come from Bavaria. My father, descended from a long line of artisans, taught me early those principles of mechanics which he knew so well. In 1870, a war broke out between Germany and France, and we were forced to flee from Paris to England. The family was very poor then, and so they sent me for my support to a cousin who lived in Germany. He was a professor of mathematics, very conscientious, very stern. I won't forget those days. They were filled with knowledge and inspiration for me. My favorite teacher was Dr. Carl von Linde. Of course, you've heard of him. He pioneered in artificial refrigeration and discovered the commercial method for making liquid air in large quantities. He taught my class in thermodynamics. How well I remember his lecture on the science of generating power.
And so, gentlemen, it's a very gloomy outlook. Extremely gloomy. Look at the inefficiency of steam. With all due regard to Mr. Watts Hinton, first, there is the coal, nature's storehouse of energy. That must be shoveled into the furnace. It then must be burned to boil water, which raises the steam. Then you must conduct the steam through pipes to the cylinder of the engine itself, which pushes the rods that drive the wheels. Cumbersome, wasteful, costless. All factors being at their best, you get only 13% of all the stored up energy and coal. That's the best, mind you. Ordinarily, the highest yield will be about 10%.
His words touched off some spark within me, released a kind of personal energy, made me want to be the one who could create an engine that would work with more efficiency than steam.
And yet, we go on incapable of doing anything about it. Nature has a vast pumping engine. Works with 100% perfection. The sun, a veritable power machine. No boilers, no pistons, no cylinders, no rods.
No boilers, von Linde said. I was filled with a new excitement. Hastily, I scribbled in my notebook the principle I had caught. Mechanical theory teaches us that only part of the heat in the fuel can now be utilized. Doesn't it follow from this that the utilization of steam or any kind of go-between is false in principle? The possibility suggests itself of putting the energy to work directly without a mediator. But how can this actually be done? That is the problem. Yes, that was the problem, and I was bound I'd find the answer, no matter how long it took. Well, I graduated from the school in Munich. But before I left, Professor von Linde called me into his study.
Rudolf, my boy, have you any plans for the future?
None, definitely.
My refrigeration company, which incidentally is doing quite well, is very much in need of a good agent in the Paris office. Do you think you'd like to go back there to fill that job?
Oh, it would be wonderful.
Then suppose we consider the contract made. We'll talk over the financial details later.
Working for Dr. von Linde was a pleasure. Within a year, I was appointed director of the company. But I did not forget the problem I had set for myself. And many a long night I spent over my drawing board, struggling to find the answer. The answer that would not come.
Rudolf, why don't you give it up?
Give up the engine? Don't be foolish, Oscar. There must be some way, and I'll find it, to utilize fuel with greater economy.
Well, other scientists have tried to find it. You've toyed with one idea after another, using ammonia gas as a fuel. Where did that get you? And if you do find a way, what then?
Oscar, there are two parts to an invention, the idea and the execution of it. Let me get the first part, and I'll not worry about the latter.
Very well. Could you spare a little time to join me in a pleasant afternoon? I've been invited to the home of a jewel merchant I knew rather well in Germany. They'd like to meet you, and you'll find them very pleasant.
Oscar was always a persistent fellow, so I agreed to go with him. I'm glad now I did, for there I met the girl I later married, Martha Flash, a tutor of French and English. Our first child, a son, was born in 1884. And within the next 5 years, we had two more children, a daughter and my youngest son, Eugene. Then we moved to Berlin, where I took over the management of Dr. von Linde's office and continued in my search for the answer to my problem. And then, in 1890, 20 years after the lecture that inspired me, I found it.
Rudolph, you surprised
me. Martha, I think I've got it. I've calculated, I've figured, I've checked every one of my calculations, and I swear I have the answer.
To the engine? To conserve steam?
Not steam. No steam at all. Now listen, beside the steam engine, there is an engine that burns gasoline. That is a little more efficient, but not nearly so efficient as mine, according to my figures. My engine will burn oil.
Oh.
I'll tell you how I hit on the idea. It came to me all of a sudden. In school, there was a little machine like a pop gun, a device to light cigars. I believe they called it a Polynesian fire syringe. It comes from the Far East.
But what has a cigar lighted to do with an...
Well, I'm coming to that. The way it works is this. Into the little cylinder of the lighter goes air, plain everyday air like we breathe. A plunger forces the air together, compresses it. Now, when air is compressed, it gets hot. And the greater the compression, the higher the heat.
So the fire...
The air in it becomes so hot, it ignites a little bit of combustible material. Result, fire. Now, instead of starting an open flame to light a cigar, suppose we inject a drop of ordinary oil into the cylinder at just the right time, when the air is hottest. The oil should explode, forcing the compressing piston back. Oh, don't you see? That must be it. No coal, no fire, no water to boil, no steam. I was sure my calculations were correct, and I immediately set about preparing a paper on the subject, describing the engine and its principle completely. It had a staggering title, The Theory and Construction of the Rational Heat Motor. The first half of my invention was done. The paper went out, and I waited for results. They came soon enough.
Ha! It's only a paper invention. I'm a practical engine builder. That sort of thing doesn't convince me.
Yes, it looks fine in the patent drawings. But when it's built, he'll find out that the old steam engine is cheaper, simpler, and more economical.
They couldn't see it. Refused to accept a paper invention. But I felt sure I was right. And with the help of a few close friends, scientific teachers I knew, we managed to enlist the financial aid of one of the biggest machine makers in the country. And we set about building the engine, the paper invention.
Poor Diesel. I feel sorry for him.
Yeah, so do I. For years he's waited for this moment. I don't see how it will work.
Let's stand a little closer.
Now, we'll turn this wheel, which builds up the initial compression.
The pump is hard to work. I'm glad Joseph is in charge of it.
Diesel has his hand on the oil injector valve. Look how excited he looks. His face is so red.
Ready now.
He's opening it.
Oh, look out! It blew up.
Mr. Diesel, are you hurt? Can you get up, Mr. Diesel?
Yes, yes, I'm all right.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Sorry? What's there to be sorry about, man? That's what I wanted to know. That proves we're on the right track. After that, there were 4 years of experimentation, 4 years of building and testing. The second engine didn't blow up, but it ran for only a minute and a half. The third was a little better, and finally the last worked perfectly.
I can't understand it. It's amazing. Diesel's engine not only works, but he's right. That cheap fuel delivers 30% of its energy in it.
Well, even a practical engineer can be fooled, you know. Those scientists have to be right sometime.
We formed a company and commenced the manufacture of the engine. The diesel motor, Martha proudly called it. By 1913, it was furnishing power and light to many communities, powering vehicles and naval vessels. Danson took it with him on the Fram to the polar regions, and then an ominous rumble of coming war began clouding the horizon. I was called to England for a conference with the Admiralty relative to using the diesel engine in submarines. I had arranged to meet two of my colleagues, George Carrels, a fellow engineer from Belgium, and a Mr. Luckman at Ghent. On the 26th of September, I motored with my son, Eugene, to Frankfurt, and then spent 2 wonderful days with my wife and daughter, excursioning through the hills, a real holiday. Eugene saw me to the station where I boarded the train for Ghent, and I was on my way. It was the last farewell to my fond family.
Ah, fine dinner, gentlemen.
Yes, Luckman, they serve good meals aboard some of these channel steamers. Don't you agree, Diesel?
Okay. Oh, yes, the meals are fine.
Shall we stroll around the deck a while before we retire?
Why not? Increase the appetite for sleep.
Oh, the channel's calm tonight. You'll have no trouble.
We walked for quite a while, several times around deck. I don't recall the conversation too well, the usual thing. And then, sufficiently tired, we said goodnight and retired to our individual staterooms, agreeing to meet on deck next morning when we should be in Harwich. Now, that night seems very long ago.
Passengers are requested to disembark immediately.
Where could Diesel be, Luckman? We've been here over 15 minutes.
I'm wondering myself, Carrels. He certainly couldn't sleep through the confusion of docking.
Well, we can't wait here for him all day. Let's have a look in his stateroom and see if he's still there.
Good idea. Come on.
That's funny. He doesn't answer. Where could he be?
Try the door. See if it's unlocked.
I say there, Diesel.
He isn't here.
Look, his bed. It hasn't been slept in all night. This is serious. Something is definitely irregular. Come, we'll find the captain.
All over that channel steamer they searched. Luckman, Carroll, the captain, the crew. But no trace of Rudolf Diesel was found. Nor has any trace been found in these many years that followed. Somewhere between France and England, Rudolf Diesel completely disappeared.
Whether he was a victim of some enemy that struck at him during the night, or whether he brought his own life to an end, no one knows. According to the writings of his son, Eugene, Diesel had speculated unwisely to promote his engine, and rather than face impending bankruptcy, ended his life in the restless waters of the English Channel. It is unfortunate that Rudolf Diesel never lived to see the day when his engine would grow into a major role in supplying power and transportation for the world. For his engine is producing today as even he might never have dreamed it would.
And we are reaping the harvest of Rudolf Diesel's adventures in research. The story you have just heard, titled The Paper Invention That Worked, is another in a series of adventures in research told by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories.
Adventures in Research, on Tuned to Yesterday from August 6th, 1946, a syndicated broadcast. And now to finish out this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday, an excerpt of the program Behind the Mic, which told stories of the broadcasting industry during its golden era. What we'll hear next is an interview with broadcasting legend Graham McNamee talking to NBC correspondent Fred Bate, who was in London, and what his experience was like reporting from a war zone. War was not foreign to Fred Bate, who had been part of the First World War effort, and through his efforts with the ambulance service there, was connected with the first American ambulance service after the war was over. This next excerpt from a program heard on December 1st, 1940, about a year and a week before the United States entered World War II.
Ladies and gentlemen, practically everyone who listens to the radio nowadays has heard news broadcasts from London by NBC reporters. But this afternoon, for the first time, we are going to bring you the behind-the-scenes picture of broadcasting from a war capital. In a few seconds, I am going to have a two-way conversation with the NBC chief commentator in London, Fred Bate, who is going to give you the behind-the-scenes picture of broadcasting from a war-torn capital. At this moment, NBC's assistant director of special events, Jack Hartley, in our New York studio, is in communication with Fred Bate, chief of NBC's staff of radio reporters in London.
Hello, Fred.
We're going to let you hear that conversation first.
Hello, Fred.
Hello, Jack.
You're going on the air in about 20 seconds. We lost you here for a few minutes. Technical difficulty, I believe.
All right.
And due to the technical setup, I won't be able to come back.
All right.
And give you a report on this program, but I will at 7:15 tonight when we contact again.
All right, Jack.
Okay, Fred, you stand by. You'll be on in 10 seconds.
I'm standing by.
Stand by.
Folks, watch your clock. In a few seconds, we'll be talking to London. Hello, Fred Bate in London. This is Graham McNamee from New York.
This is Fred Graham. How are you?
Pretty fine, Fred. Fred, I'm going to ask you for some behind-the-mic scenes, some information about the way you broadcast. First, are you speaking from a regular broadcasting studio?
Well, it's been regular since Sunday, September 3rd of last year. Before that time, it was part of the restaurant section in the basement of this studio building.
Well, do you and any of your staff live far from the studio?
For the moment, about 300 yards. That is, counting the stairs down to it.
Well, do you sleep in an air raid shelter like the rest of London?
No, I sleep in NBC's ground floor office apartment. As a matter of fact, Graham, you should have said like some of London, because only something like 20% of the people do sleep in shelters. I have slept in this studio a few times.
How many members of your staff are there to help you cover this material, Fred?
Three.
We're told, Fred, that all broadcasts coming from war capitals are censored. What's the purpose of this censorship in London?
Mainly to prevent military information going to the enemy.
Uh-huh. How much in advance of broadcast time do you have to have your material ready for censorship?
Well, theoretically, according to the rules, half an hour. But actually, Graham, in time to enable it to be read before a broadcast goes on the air.
Well, Fred, if a story breaks while you're on the air, can you use it?
Yes. If it's under no ban, that is, if no part of it contravenes defense regulations.
How do you get the information you broadcast?
Well, you get it through usual news service sources, official bulletins, and then personal observations, trips, conversations.
Well, do you have to go out during an air raid to get material concerning some story?
Sometimes, of course. But as a matter of fact, we're out every night. And there's nearly always an air raid on them.
Uh-huh. Well, do you have to wear a tin hat, Fred, when you're out covering a story?
Well, there's no obligation, but it's only sensible to wear one if you're out doing a raid. Yes, I always do. They'll turn a small splinter, we hope.
How do you get around town in order to get news and make necessary contacts?
Well, by auto or taxi or on foot. I must admit, I don't like being stuck behind a wheel if it's a bad night. It's the one thing that gives me claustrophobia. I take my hat off, Graham, to the drivers who are out night after night, no matter what it's like.
I'll bet you.
Incidentally, being an alien, I have to have special permission to have a car.
Being an alien, do you have to have special permission to get anything else?
Yes, to stay out after midnight and to visit prohibited areas.
Can you interview pilots who take part in raids, Fred?
Oh, yes, and have several times for NBC Network. Their names are never mentioned, however.
Why not?
Well, I think it's primarily a strong feeling of teamwork. The individual is merged in his unit. Then, besides, mentioning a man's name might disclose his unit, and that might disclose military information.
I see. Well, what do you do for amusement, Fred, in the little time that you're not working?
Oh,
Play golf once in a while. Go to a movie occasionally. Newsreels, usually. They only last an hour.
Do you see my newsreels, Fred?
No, not yet. When's it coming?
Anytime. Go ahead.
As a matter of fact, Graham, I find you neither miss nor particularly want amusement these days. There's a grand crowd of fellows here and plenty of amusement and conversation. But you know, a bit of fresh air, a glimpse of quiet countryside, bridges, hedges, and cattle, and the smell of burning leaves. That's the break that really counts just now.
There's one last question I think most of our listeners are curious about, Fred. On those European roundups, when we in America hear from your colleagues in Berlin, in Vichy, Rome, and other capitals, do you hear them broadcast too?
Oh, yes, Graham. Usually quite clearly. Sometimes on their way to America, that's when broadcasts are routed through London from, let's say Dublin or Cairo. When they go from European points direct to NBC, by shortwave, for instance, via RCA communications receivers, we hear them coming back from New York over the transatlantic circuit set up between NBC studios and London.
Thank you a lot, Fred. Thank you. Fred Bate from London for taking us behind the mic on your broadcasts.
I'll bet, Fred.
Good night.
Good night, John.
Good night.
An excerpt of the NBC Blue Network program Behind the Mic from December 1st, 1940. Bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.